hit a pause for a number of reasons. This came down to the growing PR front, the European and Arab Initiative, which was launched at the United Nations General Assembly, whereby Saudi Arabia and France had put forth their New York Declaration on a Palestinian state, and a number of different diplomatic issues that they were facing. The United States saw this, presented a counterproposal, and also saw that the Israelis were failing to achieve their goals militarily on the ground, or at least their stated goals militarily on the ground through Gideon's Chariots 1, and then the second part to that operation, both of which proved to be failures. So Israel wanted to assess whether they could, during a pause period, implement new agendas to take over the Gaza Strip, to implement a plan of ethnic cleansing, and of course to defeat the Palestinian national resistance. This is something that they've failed to do so far. They will very likely fail to do it in the future.
The Israeli regime continues to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement with Hamas, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, 5 civilians were killed in the latest strikes in Gaza. The new fatalities increased the number of Palestinians killed since the enforcement of the ceasefire to more than 390. Meanwhile, the regime's military vehicles opened fire on civilian homes in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Local sources noted that the Israeli artillery also targeted eastern areas of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli Navy abducted 4 Palestinian fishermen while fishing off the coast of Khan Yunis. The regime forces then blew up their boat. According to Palestinian officials, the regime's navy has killed around 230 fishermen since the Gaza genocide started, while abducting about 30 others. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed nearly 70,700 civilians, mostly women and children, since October 2023, leaving over 171,000 others injured. Our correspondent, Ghadi Ibrahim, earlier joined us from Gaza to bring us up to speed on Israel's latest violations of the ceasefire in the Palestinian territory.
Massive explosions are taking place on the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city. The outskirts of Al-Qarara, Bani Zhela and Abasan areas are subjected to very heavy attacks, artillery shelling and shooting from the Israeli tanks and the Israeli vehicles that are shooting towards the displaced families and the people behind the so-called yellow line and in the areas that are close to the so-called yellow line areas. Many people are still actually in these areas. They cannot easily evacuate to the western parts of the city, as the western parts of the Gaza Strip, the western parts of Khan Yunis, like Al-Mawazi, are really cramming with the population and cramming with the displaced families who are already lacking all the basics of survival in the western parts of the strip. In the meantime, more attacks are taking place here in the middle area on the eastern parts of Al-Ibrej and Al-Maghazi, Al-Maghazi refugee camps, and also the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah as well. More shooting, more gunfire from the Israeli tanks are actually directed towards the people homes and residential clusters and the people's tents encampments in the eastern parts of the city. This is coupled with more attacks on the eastern parts of Gaza City, like Al-Sha'af, Al-Tufah and Al-Shija'iyya neighborhoods since yesterday until this moment. More attacks are taking place against Al-Shija'iyya neighborhoods to the north of the Gaza Strip and to the north of Beit Lahia and Jabalia. More attacks are also taking place, more artillery shelling and also shooting from the Israeli lately.
Israeli forces press ahead with their month-long military aggression against Palestinian refugee camps in the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and demolishing infrastructure. In one of the latest developments, the regime forces issued a military order to demolish 25 Palestinian buildings in the North Shams refugee camp east of the city of Tol Karem. Palestinian officials condemned the move as an extension of the regime's systematic campaign of destruction and forced displacement of Palestinians in Tol Karem and North Shams refugee camps. They called Israel's new order a flagrant breach of international law, urging the international community to intervene. Meanwhile, tensions escalated in the city of Al-Khalil, where Israeli settlers staged a provocative march east of the city as the regime forces closed several Palestinian neighborhoods. Local sources said the march began near the Kiryat Arba settlement. Israeli forces tightened restrictions around the old city of Al-Khalil and the Ibrahimi Mosque, further heightening tensions. Ukraine has said it is open to drop its NATO membership bid as US and Ukrainian officials are to resume the second day of talks in Berlin. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has stated his willingness to forego his country's NATO membership in exchange for receiving security guarantees from the West. He did, however, reject US's suggestions that Kyiv cede territory to Russia. The negotiations in Berlin have been held under strict secrecy with no media access, but on Sunday, US's special envoy Steve Witkoff claimed that the talks have achieved a lot of progress. Meanwhile, Russian presidential aide Yuri Ushakov said that Moscow has not yet received any modified peace plan from Ukraine and Europe. He warned that if unacceptable terms concerning territorial issues were proposed, Russia would reject it. A group of protesters have taken to the streets of New Orleans to condemn the arrest of undocumented immigrants by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. The arrested immigrants were reportedly working at a local factory. Protesters called for the immediate release and an end to the prosecution and arrest of immigrants. The arrests are the latest in a series of immigration enforcement raids across the country. Immigration arrests under President Donald Trump's administration have continued to rise, surpassing 30,000 per month. Critics say while Immigration and Customs Enforcement is detaining more people overall, its operations are increasingly focused on individuals with no criminal convictions. Earlier this year, major U.S. cities witnessed large-scale protests against the arrest and deportation of immigrants. In some cities, Trump sent National Guard units to help suppress the demonstrations. In Australia, a Muslim bystander who disarmed a gunman during this Sunday's deadly shooting in Sydney has been praised as a hero inside and outside the country. Ahmad Al-Ahmad, a 43-year-old Syrian-born businessman, was filmed wrestling a gun from one of the assailants after they killed at least 16 people and injured 30 others during a Jewish festival. Ahmad himself was injured after the second gunman opened fire at him. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese praised him as a hero. As the video of Al-Ahmad went viral, social media users also praised his quick thinking and heroic actions. On Monday, hundreds of people also gathered at the site of the incident to lay flowers and pay tribute to the victims. The preliminary results from Chile's runoff presidential vote show the far-right candidate of the Republican Party has won the election. Chile's electoral service says José Antonio Kast has won a support of over 58%, with more than 99% of the votes counted. Jeanetta Jara from Chile's ruling left-wing coalition came in second with nearly 42% of the votes. Jara has conceded defeat in the polls. The two had failed to meet the 50% threshold to become president in the first round, which was held on November 16th. It has been 10 years since Nigerian security forces launched an attack at a worship center of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and killed hundreds of members and destroyed property. Danjuma Abdullahi filed this report on the anniversary of the gruesome incident known as the Zaria massacre.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost 5 children, 3 of which are biological, 2 of which are adopted. They were orphans, and we took them in and were taking care of them. The five of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in the all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our religion. We knew what happened. You remember in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that celebrity?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victims, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans have joined migrant workers from around the world in Seoul to protest the government crackdown and violation of migrants' rights. The demonstration follows the death of a Vietnamese migrant worker who lost her life in an immigration crackdown. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers' Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about 4 times the rate of South Korean workers.
Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that, among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you so much for staying with us. And until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Ray.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, if you remember from our last session, the title was the God of Fatima. The God of Fatima. And we were focusing on two of Allah's beautiful names. Allah has many beautiful names. We were focused on two of Allah's beautiful names, and the idea was to have these two names sit into our heart, to actualize, to realize these two names. Those two names, brothers and sisters, one of them was Kabir. Allah is Al-Kabir, but to really believe that He is great. And the second one was Al-Azim. Allah is grand. So the idea was to have some discussions where we would try to make this part of our collective existence. Now, we did take a few steps over the last three lectures, last thing. We took a few steps, but we're not out of the woods yet. We definitely haven't achieved those objectives that we were trying to get from this lecture series. If we're able to do this correctly, as a community, and I'll mention why it's so important for us as a community to do this. But inshallah, that's next. What are the objectives? What happens if myself or any of you or us as a community, we are able to come to the conclusion, and not talking about lip service, but really to believe that Allah is Azim, Allah is Kabir. What happens to a community that believes in that way? To individuals who have embraced those two names of Allah. Several things happen. Number one, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we will develop what is the Quranic definition or the Quranic expectation for the wonderful word ikhlas. We've all heard of ikhlas. We know about sincerity. There's a Quranic expectation of ikhlas that we're supposed to develop. So one of the benefits of this discussion is developing that. Number two, if we can embrace Allah with these two names, we will trust Allah with every fiber of our being. Number three, our fears and anxieties will disappear. If we're able to do this the right way, we'll go through life without fear. So number three is that our fears and our anxieties will disappear. Number four, the promises of Allah will be something that we can take to the bank. If we will rely on Allah's promises. What else? Brothers and sisters, with these two names, if they're realized the right way, you can take the word despair out of our vocabulary. We're going to end up redefining the words honor and glory. If we're able to do this the right way, we'll end up redefining these things. What we will see as honor and glory is going to be different based on the understanding. We will also see ourselves as nothing before Allah. And I'm going to mention again why I need everybody to be part of this, right? Also, our emotional relationship with Allah will be different. We're going to truly fall deeply in love with Allah. And this is just the beginning of the journey. But one of the results is that we'll really have
that deep love of Allah. What else? We will also see ourselves as nothing before Allah. So we're going to have an intense feeling of humility that, brothers and sisters, we won't even be able to describe, but it's something we have to sense that comes from those two names of Allah. Lastly, two more things. We're going to also develop a healthy fear of God. If Allah is truly Azim, then I'll develop a healthy fear of Allah, and then I will want to stay away from sin. I'll develop that motivation. And last, our ability to resist is going to increase dramatically. We will actually find ourselves enjoying difficulties. Other people are broken by masaib, difficulties, they collapse. The person who believes that Allah is Azim and Kabir will be able to enjoy those difficulties and be able to continue to resist. So the person who's like this will resist, and there's no comparison between the two. So, as I mentioned before, brothers and sisters, this is something where actually I need the help of the community. These discussions are not something that I can just say on the minbar and inshallah it'll be fixed, right? We would need to all pull our weight. If we want the next generation of Muslims not to be floundering in the same mistakes that we are, all of us have to buy in. Right now, we're not in the situation that we want to be, and I just have to be honest about that. So, inshallah, with this, we can go from being mediocre. Remember, I'm speaking to you guys, and this is an audience of practicing Muslims. We're practicing Muslims. We believe in our social and our political responsibilities. We're people of wajibat, right? So talking to this community, for this community, do we want to go on being mediocre, or are we looking for excellence? If we're looking for excellence, then these discussions are for us. That would mean then, brothers and sisters, in order for these discussions to be a success, I have to look at myself. And each one of you have to look at yourselves. Let's see, when the ayat of the Quran are speaking, are they talking to me? Is there room for me to grow? As opposed to, yeah, I hope you heard that, right? That's a different approach. This one, can I grow? Can I benefit myself? Because otherwise, then we'll continue to flounder as Muslims have floundered for a long time. Let me remind you of one of the hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He says this, Ya ayyuhan nas, O people, the Imam is addressing us, O people, طُوبَ لِمَنْ شَغَلَهُ عَيْبُهُ عَنْ عُيُوبِ النَّاسِ. Blessed, fortunate is the person who is distracted by his own flaws from the flaws of others.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Rahi Karimun Azim, Alimun Halim, Hakimun Mateen.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days from the heart of region to the global stage. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about two U.S. fighter jets entering Venezuelan airspace and flying over critical infrastructure amid heightened tensions in the region. The pair of U.S. Navy F-18 fighter jets flew over the Gulf of Venezuela, a body of water bonded by Venezuela and only about 115 miles at its widest point, and spent about 40 minutes inside Venezuelan airspace starting at around noon on Tuesday, 9 December 2025. A U.S. defense official, though, insisted that the jets stayed in international airspace during the flight. The United States has already deployed an estimated 15,000 to 16,000 troops near Venezuelan waters to pressure President Nicolas Maduro's government, and has previously sent a B-52 Stratofortress and B-1 Lancer bombers to the region, which flew up to and along the coast of Venezuela. Also, President Donald Trump bragged about seizing Venezuela's largest oil tanker during a White House press conference on Wednesday, December 10. Venezuela is one of the largest suppliers of oil to China, which has been the destination of between 55% and 90% of the country's oil exports. This week's seizure marks the first time the Trump administration has moved to interfere with the country's oil distribution amid the hostile pressure campaign. A Bloomberg report called the move a serious escalation. Speaking to reporters in the White House, Donald Trump said it's the largest one ever seized, and now other things are happening. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Meron Derakhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, what more can you tell us about two fighter jets entering Venezuelan airspace?
Yes, this was an incident on Tuesday, 9th of December. Two U.S. fighter jets circled the Gulf of Venezuela for about 40 minutes. And the two aircraft flew just north of Maracaibo, one of Venezuela's most populous cities. According to American officials, the planes conducted a routine training flight similar to previous exercises, and the jets flew between two major regions for Venezuela's energy sector, including Lake Maracaibo, the cradle of reserves containing several billion barrels of crude oil. The waters are also regularly crossed by oil tankers and load and unload crude oil at refineries in the states of Zulia and Falcon,
right,
that are key to the domestic fuel market in Venezuela and the nation's hydrocarbon sector.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Maracaibo in Zulia state is also the home to one of the main military air bases in western Venezuela.
Right. Trump administration has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, The operation was carried out by U.S. Coast Guard Force officials revealed on Wednesday, 10 December. Why did Trump order the seizure of the oil tanker?
Yes, that's right. As you said, U.S. forces have seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, and this is meant to put pressure on President Nicolas Maduro's government.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And Pam Bondi, the U.S. Attorney General, posted footage about the seizure of the oil tanker on X, and this was a 45-second video which showed U.S. military forces landing on the oil tanker from a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
In an accompanying statement, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi said the FBI, Homeland Security investigations, and U.S. Coast Guard, with support from the Pentagon, had executed a seizure warrant for a crude oil tanker used to transport sanctioned oil from Venezuela.
Right.
Venezuelan government, however, says that the seizure constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy. The Venezuelan government added, under these circumstances, the true reasons for the prolonged aggression against Venezuela have finally been revealed. It has always been about Venezuela's natural resources,
right,
in particular,
true.
Venezuela's oil, mm-hmm. its energy sector, and the resources that belong to the Venezuelan people. But interestingly enough, the U.S. President Donald Trump said, he was asked what they're going to do with the oil tanker.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump said, I assume we're going to keep the oil. So that's very interesting.
All
Trump
right.
saying he's going to keep the oil,
mm-hmm.
which many people would interpret that as meaning that one of the key reasons why the United States is putting so much pressure on Venezuela for the past 4 months is precisely because of the oil.
I see.
It wants to effectively take over control of Venezuela's oil.
All right.
Now, Attorney General Pam Bondi later expanded on Trump's statement that he's going to keep the oil. She said, we had executed a seizure warrant for a crude oil tanker, and this tanker was used to transport sanctioned Venezuelan oil. But despite this, many international observers are saying that this operation of taking over an oil tanker, it really is theft in broad daylight. So it's a complete violation
right.
of international laws,
mm-hmm.
although, as Attorney General said, a U.S. court of law has ordered the seizure of oil tanker, but the oil belongs to Venezuela and not the United States. So I'm just wondering, Donald Trump's statement that I assume we're going to keep the oil, that's what Trump said.
Yeah.
Is that legal? Certainly not. It's not legal.
Yeah. People have been killed in a series of strikes against boats suspected of transporting drugs in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific. Are these strikes legal?
That's a good question. The U.S. military, according to the latest figures we have, has launched 22 strikes on
mm-hmm.
alleged drug smuggling boats in both the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific Ocean, resulting in at least 87 deaths since early September.
Right.
And these are all classified as extrajudicial killings. And the Trump administration is targeting drug smugglers, allegedly, and the Pentagon has yet to release concrete evidence to the public that the vessels they're targeting with these airstrikes are actually carrying narcotics or drugs, and they actually do pose a threat to the United States. So far, we haven't seen anything from Pentagon to show any evidence that these
right.
boats are actually carrying
mm-hmm.
drugs and narcotics.
That's true.
The latest we have is that Congress is now demanding or threatening to withhold funds from the Pentagon unless it sees unedited videos of these airstrikes.
Mm-hmm.
One particular airstrike has very much caught the attention of lawmakers in Congress. That was one of the very first on 2nd of September. Actually, we had an airstrike on a boat which totally destroyed the boat, but two people actually survived that first attack. They were clinging on to the wreckage of the boat. But then we had a second airstrike which killed those two people.
Yeah.
And some
mm-hmm.
lawmakers in Congress have said this is a war crime because effectively the boat was totally destroyed and demolished by the first strike.
Right.
There was no
mm-hmm.
need to carry out the second strike. So the political website Politico has interviewed Donald Trump, and Politico asked Trump whether he would consider using force against targets in other Latin American countries, not just Venezuela, in other regional countries as
mm-hmm.
well, for example, Mexico and Colombia.
Right.
And and President Trump said, sure, I would. He said that if those countries, Mexico and Colombia, which are very active in drug trade, that he would consider airstrikes against those as well. So that's the latest we have.
I see. Donald Trump has warned that land attacks are coming soon to Venezuela, but has not offered any details on location. Tell us more about that.
Yes, this is the interview with the political website Politico. In this interview, Trump said that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's days are numbered, and he declined to comment on whether the U.S. could send troops underground in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Asked whether the U.S. could send in troops underground, Trump said, I don't want to comment on that.
Right.
Pressed during the interview with Politico on how far he would go to take Nicolas Maduro out of office, Trump said, I don't want to go into the details of that. They asked him, do you want to see him out? Trump replied, his days are numbered.
Asked again whether
he would rule out a U.S. ground invasion of Venezuela, Trump said, I don't want to either rule it in or rule it out. So he left that sort of ambiguous. Tensions between the United States and Venezuela have soared in recent months, and the Trump administration has conducted various strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And last month, President Trump suggested that the U.S. could very soon target Venezuelan drug traffickers on land inside Venezuela.
Mm.
That was last month.
Yeah.
So that's the latest we have on that.
I see. Lawmakers are now demanding to get an edited video from the strikes, or else they will limit Pentagon's funding. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Congress is aiming to withhold part of U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's travel budget until the Pentagon hands over video footage of the airstrikes on alleged drug smuggling boats near Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
This provision was tucked into the compromised version of the National Defense Authorization Act, an annual defense policy bill that has passed every year, and this has been so for the past six decades. Lawmakers unveiled the bill, which authorizes nearly $901 billion in defense spending.
Wow.
The bill is expected to pass both the House and the Senate with bipartisan support.
Mm-hmm.
According to the latest we have, the lawmakers are threatening to withhold a quarter of Pete Hegseth's travel funds until the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees receive unedited videos of boat strikes conducted in the area of responsibility of the United States Southern Command. The provision also requires the Pentagon to turn over overdue reports, including on lessons learned from the Ukraine war,
mm-hmm.
before the funds are released to the Pentagon. The requirement to release the video footage follows the revelation that two survivors of an initial boat strike on 2nd of September in the Caribbean Sea were killed in a follow-up strike on the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
Two sources familiar with the video of the airstrike said the two survivors were waving their hands and they were clinging on to the wreckage of the boat before they were killed in the second airstrike.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last Tuesday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dan Kane, and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefed congressional leaders and the top intelligence committee members of the House and the Senate. Military officials briefed a small number of lawmakers on the incident on 2nd of September, and there are questions about the legality of that second strike on the boat, which killed those two people, two survivors clinging on to the wreckage.
Right.
Some members of Congress were shown a video of the 2nd of September operation in last week's briefing, but the video has not been released publicly. And we know that the U.S. military have struck more than 20 alleged drug boats since early September, killing at least 87 people. President Trump initially said he would support release of the video footage about the second strike on that boat, which killed the two survivors. But later on, he seemed to backtrack on that promise.
Right.
Later on, Trump said, I don't know what they have. Whatever they have, we'll certainly release it, no problem. That's initially he said, whatever the Pentagon has, we'll release it, no problem. But on Monday, later on, Trump walked back on that promise. He said he was comfortable with whatever Pete Hegseth wants to do. So he said he was comfortable.
Right.
And Pete Hegseth actually said that he may not release the video of the second strike on the boat. He cited ongoing operations in the region. He said this is confidential. So Pete Hegseth suggested that he may not actually release that video.
Right.
We'll be right back.
listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. President Maduro has said the real reason for Trump's fixation on Venezuela is oil. What do you think about that?
Yes, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says the real motive behind the massive U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean Sea is all about oil. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, even larger than Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. State Department denies this. The U.S. State Department insists that the airstrikes on boats that have killed more than 80 people, this is part of a campaign against drug trafficking. But what has now become clear, certainly in the past few weeks, is that Donald Trump is absolutely determined on regime change in Venezuela.
That's true.
I mean, the size of the military forces in the Caribbean Sea suggests very much regime change. And we can say that Trump has proved happy to reach an understanding with authoritarian leaders elsewhere, for example. And we can also say that these airstrikes on various boats and vessels in the Caribbean Sea, these are unlikely to have much impact on the flow of drugs in the United States. In fact, most experts say that the majority of those drugs flow into the United States by land through the vast southern border with Mexico. So critics are saying that these airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea, allegedly drug boats, they won't have much effect in sort of restricting the supply of drugs into the United States, because most of the drugs are coming through land through the border with Mexico.
That's right.
Now, what about Colombia? Well, Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, who is himself is involved in a bitter feud with Donald Trump, he has described the last campaign in the last 3 or 4 months against Caracas as a negotiation about oil. So again, Colombia's president, a next door neighbor to Venezuela, he thinks that much of what is going on in the Caribbean Sea and all this pressure on Nicolas Maduro is a sort of a negotiation about oil. And Colombian president Gustavo Petro said Trump is not thinking about democratizing Venezuela, much less about drug trafficking. He's simply interested in the oil.
Right. Russian President Vladimir Putin has expressed his solidarity with the Venezuelan people. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the Kremlin said in a statement that Vladimir Putin spoke with Nicolas Maduro by phone and reaffirmed his support to the Venezuelan leader. President Putin said Maduro's policy of protecting national interests and sovereignty in the face of growing external pressure. He said Russia backs Venezuela. And this phone call actually happened after U.S. military forces seized that oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. So the phone conversation took place after the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military. President Maduro has insisted the real purpose of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean Sea near Venezuela is really to do with Venezuela's oil.
Right.
As far as the oil tanker is concerned, the Venezuelan government has said the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy. The Venezuelan government has added President Putin told President Maduro that direct communication between Moscow and Caracas would remain permanently open and Russia would continue to support Venezuela in its struggle to assert its sovereignty, international law, and peace throughout Latin America.
Right.
Now, I can say that just like his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro has forged a close relationship with Russia. And another thing I can mention is that back in 2018, there was a brief period when Russia dispatched a pair of Tu Tupolev 160 bombers to an airport just outside Venezuela's capital, Caracas. And this was back in 2018. So the Russians have given military support to Venezuela in the past as well.
Right. To sum up very briefly then, the seizure of the oil tanker near Venezuela's coastline is literally theft in broad daylight, and Trump's claim that he wants to keep the oil shows that a major motivation for attacking is to take control of Venezuela's oil. Thank you, Mr. Grashunder, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
Before over a million times, who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the moment so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever? Won't you be my partner after this world? We'll see, we believe it together. Dreams are meant to be, 'cause you're the one. Every single day, I'll just say it, 'cause you're the one. And when times are tough, we've got the world to see. Standing right beside you is where I wanna be. I just know it, you are the one. Won't you be? Just over a million times, who had ever thought that I could call you mine? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. And when there's gray in our hair, we've not much to do. I wanna spend the rest of my days with you. Oh, don't you know it? You are the one. Won't you be the one?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a televised address to the Iranian people on September 23, 2025. My My second point is that negotiating with the U.S. in the current situation would bring great harm to the country. And what they want from the negotiations is for Iran to not have uranium enrichment. Now, he's spoken about enrichment. A few days ago, the vice president declared that Iran mustn't have missiles either. Neither long-range missiles, nor medium-range missiles, and not even short-range missiles. He says we, that is Iran, mustn't have any of these. This means they want Iran's hands to be so tied and empty that even if it's attacked, it won't be able to respond or retaliate against a U.S. base in Iraq or anywhere else. That is what this demand means. Should we enter negotiations for such an outcome? Well, that would have no benefit. That would be negotiations where there is no benefit for us. The result of such talks would only be harm for us. That is coercion. That means accepting the U.S.'s coercion and imposition. That isn't negotiations. When one is dealing with Islamic Iran, these kinds of expectations and statements stem from a failure to know the Iranian nation. They stem from a failure to know the Islamic Republic. The reason for this is that they don't know the philosophy, foundations, and guiding principles of Islamic Iran. They talk like this because they don't understand these things. As we, the people of Mashhad, say, this talk is bigger than the mouth that uttered it. And this talk isn't worth paying attention to, this talk of negotiating for such an outcome. So such negotiations would have no benefit for us. Now, as for the harm, I say it has harms, and this is the more important point. The other side has threatened that if we don't negotiate, this and that will happen. They say, we'll bomb you, or we'll do this and that. There are threats of this nature. Some are vague, and others are stated bluntly. They say, either negotiate, or if you don't, this and that will happen. This is a threat. Well, accepting such negotiations would signify that the Islamic Republic of Iran is susceptible to threats. If you go and enter negotiations after such threats, it would mean that in the face of any threat, we are immediately frightened, tremble, and surrender to the opposing side. That is what it would mean.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. I'm Asma here in Tehran announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with today's special daily mix format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Then we have our radio productions feature. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program, Today's Special.